Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. High stakes. Congress passes a key government funding measure, but Democrats remain divided at a critical juncture amid tense legislative negotiations. Then, getting the vaccine. The Centers for Disease Control issues an urgent appeal calling on pregnant women to get vaccinated against COVID-19. And a country in crisis, Mozambique battles an ISIS-affiliated insurgency. We examine the drivers of the conflict and the few options left for everyday citizens.
We blame the bosses of our country. If they didn't want their people to suffer, they wouldn't give our country's wealth to foreigners. They would leave it to us.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. It is all but certain that there will be no government shutdown tonight. A bill extending funding for 2 months is now before President Biden after it cleared Congress this afternoon. Still, for the White House and congressional Democrats, the pressure is not over. For much of today, it wasn't certain whether the U.S. House would vote on a $1 trillion infrastructure bill tonight, as Speaker Nancy Pelosi has promised. Lisa Desjardins and Yamiche Alcindor have been following all the twists and turns in this story today, and they join me now. So first of all, Lisa, yes. You're wearing an eye patch. You hurt your eye. Are you all right?
You noticed, of course, yes, I'm fine. No one in Congress is responsible for this. It was my own fault. I was rushing. I was thinking about something intensely, and I actually pulled a car door into my face. But I will be fine, and it's just a reminder maybe we all need to slow down.
And we want you to take care of yourself.
I will.
It will get better. So about what's going on, where do things stand? Is it thought that Speaker Pelosi is going to go ahead with this vote tonight?
Yes, it is. What a dramatic day. That wasn't what we were expecting when we woke up this morning. I want to remind people about what's happening here with these two bills. Let's look at this reminder of where we're at. First of all, these are critical decisions. The infrastructure bill still needs to be passed by the House to become law. It is bipartisan. But House progressives want that reconciliation bill, that large Biden agenda bill with child care and climate in it, to go first. So they were reluctant. And they say there will even be no votes on the infrastructure bill. But nonetheless, Pelosi has said, and I have been hearing, that the vote will be tonight after 9 o'clock Eastern time. Now, what progressives are waiting for especially is the word of two senators, Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin, the sort of moderates who have been holding out, saying $3.5 trillion, what progressives want, is too high. But until today, Joe Manchin had not said exactly what number he wants. He did do that today. Let's listen.
My top line has been 1.5 because I believe in my heart that what we can do and what the needs we have right now and what we can afford to do without basically changing our whole society to an entitlement mentality.
Now, protesters were actually not far away from where Senator Manchin was speaking, and that's $1.5 trillion he was talking about, $2 trillion away from what these folks right there want instead. And a lot is on the line, no question. We do expect this vote tonight, but we don't know exactly how Speaker Pelosi will get those votes. As of yesterday, she seemed to be missing 40 to 60 votes of progressives who said they were a no. House Republicans say they're not going to make up that difference. But she is saying she's confident, and it's a mystery to how one of the best legislators in modern American history will make this up. We're going to watch closely.
Well, sounds like it's going to be a late night.
I think so.
So meantime, at the White House, Yamiche, tell us what is going on there, what the president and his people are up to, and what is their sense of how all this is going to impact the president's agenda?
Well, it's a great question, Judy, and I just want to say the fact that Lisa is reporting with an eye patch shows you the dedication that we have and how lucky we are to have her on a day like today when it's so intense. So, Lisa, hang in there. We're all rooting that you will be fine. As to what is happening today at the White House, the president and White House aides have spent all day scrambling, trying to get Democrats on the same page. Now, the president has not been seen in public. It's because I'm told that he has been behind the scenes talking to lawmakers, making the pitch that he needs his party to get together to try to pass this robust agenda that he promised to the American people. Another thing to notice, the president is really making this pitch to his party. We all want to be on the same page in terms of infrastructure. We all want children to have clean drinking water. We all want children to be able to have access to broadband, especially in the middle of a pandemic. That's also why he's been telling lawmakers that he doesn't want to link the bills, because the first bill, the one that's bipartisan, he does see it as a critical first step to really helping people and Americans who need the help now. That said, this really is, of course, the president's legacy on the line here. It's a huge test for his party. And I will also say that the White House is saying that even if this doesn't happen today, there are other days to come. This is, of course, a deadline that Democrats set for themselves. But White House officials have been telling me, even after today, they hope this process continues. They're not admitting failure, but they are hinting at the fact that the president will continue to try to get votes for that larger infrastructure bill if it doesn't work out today.
Hard to think of a more stressful time at the White House than it is right now. But Lisa, whatever happens with this infrastructure legislation, what is the sense of what Democrats are going to do going forward now?
With reconciliation, that big bill, this is really the quandary for them. Tough choices are ahead, Judy. It is not going to be $3.5 trillion. I don't think it's going to be that large. They're going to have to compromise between themselves. To do that, they're going to have to cut something from it. Is it childcare? Is it climate? How do they handle that? Those talks are beginning now. So basically, while many Democrats wanted this process to be ending this week, the truth is the negotiations on reconciliation among Democrats are really just beginning.
Oh, well, the long journey of that legislation. Right. Lisa Desjardins, please take care of yourself. Yamiche Alcindor, please take care of yourself. Thank you both. In the day's other news, on this last day of September, the stock market closed out a month of stark downturns. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 546 points today to close at 33,844. The Nasdaq fell 64 points. The S&P 500 slipped 52. Overall, the S&P and the Nasdaq had their worst month since the pandemic started, down nearly 5% or more. The Dow lost more than 4% for its worst month in nearly a year. The National School Board Association sought federal help today to investigate threats over mask mandates and other pandemic measures. The group wrote to President Biden and warned that rising violence and threats are, quote, equivalent to a form of domestic terrorism and hate crimes. Meanwhile, at a U.S. Senate hearing, Health Secretary Javier Becerra said there is plenty of precedent for COVID protective measures.
50 years ago, some people protested using seatbelts. Today, we don't. We know how safe and effective they are. Same thing with vaccines, same thing with masks, same thing with social distancing, same thing with better ventilation, same thing with better hygiene. We know what works. It's common sense.
At the same hearing, Education Secretary Miguel Cardona condemned hostility against school board members. He said that in some places, it has turned dangerous. The Biden administration is rolling out a more lenient approach to immigration enforcement. New guidelines will target only migrants who illegally entered the country since last November or who pose a threat to public safety. Then President Trump directed authorities to go after anyone in the country illegally. The new rules take effect November 29th. The number of suicides in the active duty U.S. military rose 15% last year to 580. The overall suicide rate rose only slightly. The figures are part of a Pentagon report released today. Officials say they did not see any influence from the COVID pandemic. U.S. senators attacked Facebook today over findings that its Instagram platform can harm teenagers' mental health. The Wall Street Journal has reported that Facebook's own research shows peer pressure on Instagram fuels eating disorders and suicidal thoughts. Today, Democrat Richard Blumenthal challenged the company's global safety chief, Antigone Davis, as she disputed those accounts.
We are looking to find ways to release more of this research. I want to be clear that this research is not a bombshell. It's not causal research. It's, in fact, just
directional
research.
Well, I beg to differ with you, Ms. Davis. This research is a bombshell. It is powerful, gripping, riveting evidence that Facebook knows of the harmful effects of its site on children, and that it has concealed those facts.
Next week, the senators will hear from a Facebook whistleblower who is believed to have leaked the research. In France today, a Paris court convicted former President Nicolas Sarkozy of campaign financing violations. He was accused of spending nearly twice the legal amount on his failed re-election bid in 2012. Sarkozy is appealing an earlier conviction for corruption. Today, he was sentenced to a year of house arrest. He appealed that as well. And Korean automaker Hyundai is recalling 550,000 Hyundai and Kia vehicles in the U.S. over faulty turn signals. The company says that the signals can flash the opposite of what a driver intends. The recall includes Hyundai and midsize Sonatas and Sedona minivans made by Kia from model years 2015 to 2017. Still to come on the NewsHour, the CDC calls for urgent action to increase COVID vaccines among people who are pregnant. A massive Chinese company's financial troubles threaten an already unstable market. One African country's battle against an ISIS-affiliated insurgency, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
As Democrats work to reach an agreement on trillions of dollars of government spending, the fate of the bill's final price tag and the successful passage of the president's overall legislative agenda largely hinges on receiving support from two key influential Democratic senators, West Virginia's Joe Manchin and Arizona's Kyrsten Sinema. We have reports on how they each think about politics and the pressures they face in their home states, beginning with Lisa Desjardins, who's back, but she was in the Mountain State.
In West Virginia, high school football gets you full-throated field-rushing tradition and a stadium full of political insight from those who've known Joe Manchin the longest.
His office was right next door to mine.
We went to the same church for a while.
He fishes up where I fish.
I was probably a freshman when he is senior year quarterbacking, yes.
They're from Joe Manchin's home county, where his identity was forged, starting on the football field as a standout player. But now the game and winning are much more complicated.
I just don't agree with his politics.
From right of center.
Not the way they're taking over United States. Everything's wrong.
And from left.
Therefore,
I think he's
second and 16.
Letting the Democratic Party down.
Now the brick house, that's there, the Manchin's house.
Stephanie Cummins gives us a tour of Farmington, her hometown, and Manchin's.
Does everybody know Joe Manchin here?
If they don't, they know a cousin or a brother or some type of relation.
400 people and one stoplight, Farmington was built up by coal miners. For those wondering why Manchin is a Democrat, much of it is here. Cummins and her grandmother, who live next to each other, point to the tight-knit immigrant community.
Italians, you had
Croatians.
Polish, all these different countries. But when they got here, they were all on an even kind of playing field.
This building was the Manchin's grocery store. They also owned the furniture store where Manchin worked. The stores and family framed his brand of Democrat. His family regularly helped struggling miners with food and clothes, and everyone was expected to work hard.
You don't get things for free, but at the same time, you know, being in that environment, he saw all the good deeds and the way they kind of paid it forward to other families.
He always stood out because he wanted to help.
Over 20 years, Manchin rose from state delegate to governor. Skilled at reading political winds, he worked by forcing opposite sides to talk. And Manchin often got his way, cutting taxes while expanding a few pieces of the social safety net. Here he is at the 2008 Democratic Convention.
We reduced the size of state government and tackled our debts. Now the time has come for Washington to follow our example and bridge partisan divides to bring America the change it needs.
That year as governor, Manchin swept every county in the state. But just a decade later, in 2018, Senator Manchin barely won. the state has shifted dramatically to the right. Some Democrats are shifting on Manchin, too, with pressure from home state and younger progressives worried that he's blowing it on big issues.
There are some things that are like existential right now. Climate change, existential. The state of the pandemic where we're on fire right now, existential.
20-year-old Jared Powell shows us the pictures of his beloved dad, who died of COVID last year.
That chair right there, that was the last seat he got to sit in this house because he had to search for an insurance card.
Powell wants government to do more than Manchin does. He remembers a teacher offering to keep him fed when his dad lost his job.
I took from it a lesson in how, to be a West Virginian. It's like, we care for those that need care. Oh,
absolutely. He believes Manchin has good intentions.
But is he making the kinds of deals you think should be made right now for the country?
No. I don't know how long this window of opportunity for Democrats is going to remain open in Washington.
That's Mike Caputo, current state senator, Manchin ally, and longtime union leader for miners. Manchin was governor during two major coal disasters with 41 deaths, and afterward led pushes on mining safety and miner benefits.
His care about health and safety on the job makes him a Democrat.
And of course, coal is a major factor in Manchin's pushback at climate change ideas. On most everything else, Caputo wants Manchin to lean more left, but he sees the headlines and anger from outside groups and says those miscalculate.
I think he makes his decision based on what he believes is the right thing to do for West Virginia. And I don't think he'll cave to that type of outside pressure.
And from voters here, we heard one critique the most, that Manchin sits on the fence too often and for too long, but not in doubt that Manchin is the same middle-of-the-road Democrat who was first elected to office 40 years ago. In Farmington, West Virginia, I'm Lisa Desjardins.
I'm Stephanie Tsai at the Arizona State Capitol in Phoenix, where Kyrsten Sinema started her political career. Unlike Senator Joe Manchin, Sinema wasn't always the centrist willing to reach across the aisle. In fact, in her early activist days, she used to attend protests regularly on this very lawn. Her reputation was as a liberal flamethrower. Her move to the center has confounded and angered progressive Democrats. Kyrsten Sinema used to lead protests. Now the tables have turned. Since the summer, she's been the target of anger by activists in the Democratic Party, from the civil rights leader Jesse Jackson to workers' rights leader Dolores Huerta, who last week melted an ice sculpture of Senator Sinema in effigy.
Like this beautiful ice statue that we have here. Your support, Senator Sinema, is going to melt away.
Chanel Powell, an educational and political consultant in Phoenix, says she's volunteered for Sinema for more than a decade.
I would cling to her every word, and she would talk about, having the proper education and, knowing how to interact with, opposing views. But it was always still standing on your values. It wasn't selling out, right? I remember Kyrsten when she was approachable.
She should definitely be classified as a liberal.
David Wells, a political science professor at Arizona State University, attended rallies with Sinema, protesting the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's watched her political arc.
She ran for legislature the first time as an independent because she didn't want it to be outside the two parties. And she worked really hard, but she lost. And then she ran as a Democrat and won in the House.
From there to the state Senate, and then elected to Congress.
I like the fact how she kind of bucked the status quo at the time and really standing up as if she was the people's champion.
In 2018, she became the first Democrat elected to represent Arizona in the Senate since 1995 and the first woman.
Arizonans don't care whether you have an R or a D at the end of your name. What they care about is whether or not you're able to deliver real results for everyday Arizonans.
I'm an old man and I'm a former Republican. And
you're a conservative.
Very.
Okay, so what do you like about Senator Sinema?
Everything. She's young, she's cute, she's 42 years old, she has two masters, she has a law degree, and she's run in two Ironmans.
Rick Ireland is a staunch Sinema supporter.
When I tell people that I was on her selection committee, they would say, do you know who she is? Do you know she's very liberal, she wears pink tutus, and she's anti this and she's anti that.
But Ireland, a former Army officer and businessman, sees beyond her brazen fashion statements and early activism and says she's grown up.
Kirsten, to me, is neither right nor left. She's right down the middle. She reminds me of my political hero in this state, and that's John McCain.
John McCain was Arizona's senator for more than three decades, and there are signs Senator Sinema has taken cues from the man known as a maverick. Last March, Sinema voted no to increasing the minimum wage to $15 an hour in a COVID stimulus bill.
Ms. Sinema, no.
Giving a thumbs down, echoing McCain's game-changing vote against repealing the Affordable Care Act. But for Chanel Powell, Sinema's performance that day was a stab in the heart.
I got goosebumps, right? Because she know. Again, these are the same families from the organizers who have been knocking on doors and making phone calls and persuading voters to vote for her to say that she was going to be our champion.
This sentiment may put Sinema at risk if she faces a Democratic primary challenger in 2024. But David Wells says Sinema's shift to the middle reflects her pragmatic side and her view toward the long game.
And the Republicans are going to have a very hard time running anybody of note against her.
An unlikely duo, Kirsten Sinema and Joe Manchin, two senators, two critical votes deciding the Democratic agenda in Washington. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai in Phoenix, Arizona.
And Lisa joins me again. So Lisa, you and Stephanie both looking at these two senators, their background, their politics. Mm-hmm. But what do you know, what do we know about their role as negotiators right now?
There's so much to say. They are actually very different kind of negotiators. Both of them try to forge compromise. They're both good at it. However, from my reporting, what's happening right now, Kirsten Sinema is a policy wonk. She has spreadsheets. She's looking at different kinds of policies in reconciliation, how much they cost, what they mean. Joe Manchin, he's looking at the 30,000-foot view. He's got maybe six or seven overarching goals, but he's not getting into the weeds. What he wants is for the opposing sides to come together and duke it out in a room and then get into the weeds. They're also a little different in terms of how they work with their states. Joe Manchin is a son of West Virginia, and, you know, someone told me everyone has his cell phone in West Virginia. I asked 134 people, random people that I didn't know. Three of them did have Joe Manchin's cell phone, and about 60 of them said, I know someone who has Joe Manchin's cell phone. His cell phone went off today during his news conference. So his greatest influence comes from his state, and that's something to know.
The other thing that we need to say about these two individuals is they're what they face in terms of the election. They are both up in 2024. What are the political calculations at this moment looking ahead?
Kirsten Sinema is from a purple state where there are very sort of fractured divides politically. Now, there is a big question for both of these lawmakers. Does Donald Trump run for president in 2024? That will affect their fate dramatically. Now, however, Kirsten Sinema, it's a little different there where we saw Joe Biden win. For Joe Manchin, he has survived in one of the most Trump states in the country, you know, but it will make things harder for him if Trump runs. That's part of their, I think, thinking right now. They both want to stay representing and serving their states in 4 years. They also are hearing a lot from what their constituents' political say about what this means for their party. So those are the two dynamics that are difficult for them right now.
It's over 3 years away, but yeah, it's still very much in focus.
It is.
Lisa Desjardins, thank you again.
You're welcome.
The CDC released its most urgent appeal to date, calling on pregnant women to get vaccinated against COVID-19. New CDC data show that pregnant women are twice as likely to be hospitalized if they get the virus. More than 22,000 women have been hospitalized so far. 161 have died, and 22 of those deaths were in August. Amna Nawaz has more on the vaccine and the risks of the virus.
That's right, Judy. Just 32% of pregnant women are currently vaccinated, and the racial disparities are stark. Among Asian women, 47% are vaccinated, as are 35% of white women. Among Hispanics and Latinas, only 27% are inoculated, and among black women, just 17%. We explore this all with OBGYN Dr. Joya Creer Perry. She's also founder and president of the National Birth Equity Collaborative. That's an organization focused on the reproductive health and well-being of black women. Dr. Creer Perry, welcome to the NewsHour. Thank you for making the time. Let's start with the overall number. What do we know about why those vaccination rates, specifically for pregnant women, are so low?
Well, we took a long time to really get around to pregnant women. If you think about the beginning of this pandemic, we were focused on the elderly, on frontline workers, and so our messaging and our outreach really focused on those areas. And for so long, that kind of left pregnant women, as well as pregnant people, as well as children, out of the conversation. So it's confusing, I'm sure, if you're pregnant right now to say, it's been 18 months, why now are you coming to me saying I need to be vaccinated? So we have to do a really good job of explaining that, although in the beginning, we didn't have data that showed that it was important for pregnant people to become vaccinated because they weren't the most at risk. We got those frontline workers vaccinated, we got the elderly vaccinated, and now the virus has moved on to the next host, right? And the next host who is unvaccinated is going to be pregnant people and children, because we didn't include them in the beginning. So the science tells us it's time that we really beef up our efforts in reaching out to that group.
So what is an urgent action from the CDC change? What does that mean? How does that get more shots in arms?
Yeah, it's really important, because I know from my colleagues who are OBGYNs, many people are not telling their patients to become vaccinated. So when we see a call from the CDC, we heed that as providers, as scientists, as healthcare, and midwives, as OBGYNs, the CDC saying, hey guys, you need to make sure that pregnant people are vaccinated. That means our job is to respond, ensure that our patients, when they come in for their prenatal care appointments, we offer the vaccine, we have it in our offices, when they show up in labor and delivery, that it's available. It really changes the sense of urgency when the CDC says to the medical community, this is important, and our job is to respond so that our patients can thrive.
And doctor, what about the gap we're seeing across racial and ethnic backgrounds? What should we attribute that to?
We know that there is warranted mistrust, that we have history and legacy between Henrietta Lacks, the history of J. Marion Sims, that the Black community, Black birthing people, have a mistrust of the healthcare system. But that's an opportunity. We can really lean in and ensure that we give them the information that they need so they can make a good decision that, with a trusted provider. So this is our opportunity for my field to invest in trust building.
We've also seen pregnant women and women who hope to be pregnant targeted with misinformation online. I want to tick through some of the things we've seen and get you to quickly address them. From the studies you've seen so far, is there any evidence the vaccine causes infertility if you're trying to get pregnant?
Yeah, there is no evidence that vaccine causes infertility. In fact, we are worried in the future we might find out that COVID causes infertility, because we know it causes blood vessel damage. And you have blood vessels around your ovaries, around your reproductive parts. And so you want to get vaccinated to protect your fertility, not because it does not harm it.
Any evidence that the vaccine increases a chance of miscarriage or stillbirth?
There is no evidence that the vaccine causes either miscarriage or stillbirth. We know that COVID causes premature birth. People who are contracting the virus are having babies too small, who are not living and who are being born in the, and having to go to the ICU. So instead of us focusing on the vaccine, we should really be worried about the virus. The virus causes illness. The virus causes babies to be too early. So getting the vaccine protects your baby and protects you from having a baby that's too small.
So if someone is pregnant or thinking about becoming pregnant, what would be your best advice to them right now if they're on the fence about getting the shot so they feel better about that decision?
It's important to talk to your provider, which is probably one of the reasons why we see lower rates with Black and Latina folks, because we don't have necessarily a continuous provider, but a trusted provider to ensure that you feel comfortable and get all of your occurrences, your answers, your questions answered, because we want you to get the vaccine. We want you to be safe. And so going, if you're thinking about being pregnant, if you're trying to get pregnant, or if you're already, or if you're lactating, all of those times are still very safe to be vaccinated, and ensure that your provider has a conversation with you to make sure that your, all your questions are answered so we can get you vaccinated.
That is Dr. Joya Creer Perry, founder and president of the National Birth Equity Collaborative. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
too big to fail was a phrase used during the 2008 financial crisis for large companies so overextended that their collapse could cripple the global markets. Now, China is trying to make a too big company with too much debt that's already missed key payments and manage its failure. The company is a real estate giant called Evergrande. Nick Schifrin explains.
The mission was Occupy Evergrande. In a country where protest is often prohibited, earlier this month, Evergrande's investors filled the company's lobby to chant, "Give us our money back." They direct their fury at an Evergrande manager. His solution is rejected, and he's dejected next to a woman who speaks for the crowd.
If they don't give me my money back, then I'll jump off a tall building. They've cheated me out of all my money. I have nothing left.
The Grand Debut.
Evergrande built itself and helped China build extraordinary growth thanks to those tall buildings. This promotional clip shows Evergrande apartments for China's booming upper middle class. Evergrande became one of the country's largest real estate developers by building apartments across 8,000 sites and pre-selling them before they were done. That means half-built apartments remain unfinished, even though people like Fan Wanting already paid.
We definitely hope that the government will come out and give us an assurance. We still have to pay the mortgage.
But it was Xi Jinping's government that looked at Evergrande and China's real estate giants and decided to cut them down to size. At one point, Evergrande's CEO reportedly rejected a $100 million yacht as too plain.
Evergrande is now basically the poster child for what Beijing is looking to do as it reins in this sector.
Michael Hirschen is the China practice head for the Eurasia Group and the former U.S. Treasury chief representative in Beijing. He says the $300 billion of debt amassed by Evergrande, whose headquarters towers over Shenzhen, China's Silicon Valley, was considered too risky.
China is now basically 5 years into what they're calling a financial de-risking campaign. And essentially, it's a reflection of the fact that Xi Jinping and the Chinese leadership realize if they don't get serious about debt risks, it could bring the whole system down.
But in reining Evergrande in, the Communist Party faces risks, not only of more protests outside of Evergrande's headquarters that police tried to hide, but also contagion. Last week, Evergrande's troubles led to the Dow Jones's worst day in months. Experts say Evergrande is not a repeat of Lehman Brothers in 2008, when bankers left their jobs with only cardboard boxes and left the global financial system on the verge of collapse. But especially when it comes to real estate, what happens in China doesn't stay in China.
In a worst-case scenario, what we would see is the fallout from Evergrande ripple through the sector. A fall in property prices, property sales, property demand that would really have a big impact on China's growth.
And a ripple in China, of course, could mean a ripple globally, right?
If you think of the property sector in China as 25 to 30% of China's economy, well, then think as well of the fact that China has been generating about 30% of global growth in recent years. So this is an engine for China's economy, and China is an engine for the global economy.
Beijing assures the world even if there's no bailout, Evergrande won't explode and its implosion can be controlled.
Various regions and various government departments have adhered to the principle of housing for living in, not speculation, and stabilized housing prices. The overall situation has retained a stable trend.
But China faces economic headwinds and now rolling blackouts. The lights are out in many shops and factories and could delay this year's holiday shipments. The cuts come from Beijing's reining in emissions from coal-fired plants to meet environmental targets. Beijing thinks cleaning up notorious pollution is popular and helps long-term stability. But that requires short-term pain, and whether it's electricity or housing, the risk is the Communist Party will fail to deliver the immediate prosperity it believes creates stability.
You've got President Xi striking this theme of common prosperity, which means equitable gains for households. The party is going to take care of you. It's going to ensure quality of life. And obviously, having households now purchasing apartments that don't get delivered, looks worse than ever.
Beijing is trying to reform and reduce risk without sparking crises. Whether it can succeed could determine the country's economic future. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin. We'll be right back.
The Southeast African nation of Mozambique is being terrorized by Al-Shabaab, an ISIS-affiliated insurgency that has killed 3,000 people and displaced many more. We first reported from there earlier this year, and with the support of the Pulitzer Center, special correspondent Neha Wadakur and filmmaker Ed Rahm recently returned to Mozambique to report on the drivers of this conflict.
Islamic insurgents have been pushing for control in Cabo Delgado, northern Mozambique, since 2017. In their own videos, they pledge allegiance to the so-called Islamic State and show off their weapons. They build their territory by terrorizing towns and villages. The conflict has displaced more than 800,000 people. Families flee beheadings and horrific violence. And human rights workers struggle to keep up with the flow of people and reach those trapped in the middle of the conflict zone. 100 miles south of the fighting, people displaced by the violence live here with local families, and the host community is flooded with newcomers. In this village, we meet 28-year-old Louisa Victor. Louisa and her baby were held captive for a month after insurgents attacked her village.
I was scared and shaking, and I was crying. I couldn't look at them.
Before escaping, Victor witnessed the insurgents' brutality.
We saw them beheading men. They would hold the men by the ears and tie them to posts. Then they would behead them and take the heads and bring the heads inside to show us. They said, this is the work that we do.
Many of the displaced people we met during our 2 weeks in Cabo Delgado said they'd also witnessed beheadings and obscene violence. Their stories made us want to understand the motives of the insurgents beyond the narrative of Islamic extremism. Cabo Delgado is rich in natural resources, but while most local people still live in extreme poverty, it's large international companies that profit from the region's wealth. The insurgency has grown around one of Africa's largest foreign investments, a $20 billion natural gas project run by French energy giant Total. In March, the insurgents mounted a significant attack in Palma, where the project is located, prompting Total to suspend its operations. Total Energies told PBS NewsHour that it's committed to ensuring that local communities benefit from the project. The same preconditions for insurgency that exist around the gas project are also growing around one of Cabo Delgado's most infamous industries. Mining. We trek deep into a forest near Monte Pues, Cabo Delgado's major mining area, to gain access to illegal gold and ruby mines. Multinationals, including the UK-based company Gemfields, have bought rights from the Mozambican government to extract precious minerals and stones from this area. These miners say that the presence of large companies has left them little choice but to dig illegally.
We blame the bosses of our country. If they didn't want their people to suffer, they wouldn't give our country's wealth to foreigners. They would leave it to us. As you can see, these people around are very angry.
Reports suggest that requests from big businesses for mining concessions have increased as the conflict has escalated, an indication that mining companies are benefiting from the insurgency.
The men in this mine are working under tough conditions and say they're often beaten and chased away by security forces. Being pushed out of the mineral industry is one of the many reasons why the people of Cabo Delgado province are unhappy with their government.
In Monte Pues's famous ruby mines, the conflict between illegal miners and multinationals boils down to a simple problem.
White people want the stones. We want them too.
And experts on the conflict are concerned that it's this anger with the government in Cabo Delgado that's fueling the insurgency. Joao Feijo works for the Rural Environment Observatory, which aims to contribute to the sustainable development of rural regions like Cabo Delgado.
Montepuez has in fact all the conditions for the insurgents to install. These mining projects only increase social differentiation, so it creates this sense of anger, of social tension and revenge.
In a statement, Gemfields told PBS NewsHour that a country's gemstones are not resources to be looted purely for personal gain, and said the suggestion that mining has contributed to the insurgency is absurd and misleading. In addition to minerals and natural gas resources, there is also a large timber trade in Cabo Delgado, where trees are cut down legally and illegally and shipped to China. Experts suspect that insurgents could be felling trees in the land they control and selling wood to fund their operations. And the more money the insurgents make, the more villages they can attack, sending dozens of people each day south to Pemba, Cabo Delgado's capital city. Insurgents control the roads further north, so many people flee the fighting by boat.
My children and I were seasick. We were vomiting. Everyone in the boat was vomiting.
Nazira Sumaila and her family complete their long journey to her mother's house. Relief as the loved ones are reunited. Fatima Saidi, Nazira's mother, had been waiting for her daughter and grandchildren with no news.
We spent almost 2 months without even going home, waiting for my children to arrive at the beach.
Back on Pemba's beaches, it's not just people arriving by boat. Cabo Delgado is a key point along international drug trade corridors. Drugs arrive in Pemba's port on cargo ships, or are transferred to small fishing boats and brought to shore. One drug dealer was willing to speak with us under the condition of anonymity.
Where do the drugs come in from?
Heroin comes from Pakistan, and cocaine can come from Brazil or Colombia.
Can you give us details about when they come in at the port?
They're packing like the same bag of rice, the same bag of sugar. They're bringing it by ship, they're using the sea, and they're loading Pemba, then they divide in different countries.
Heroin is estimated to be Mozambique's second largest export. Huge quantities of drugs are transported down to South Africa and on to Europe. And analysts blame high-level corruption.
It's not possible to make a business like this without the involvement of the Mozambican big man, from the government and from the army.
Interest in preserving this secretive black market economy makes Cabo Delgado fertile ground for the insurgency to thrive. We wanted to ask the government about the marginalization of miners, the drug trade, and multinational business interests, but the Cabo Delgado regional authorities declined our request for an interview. In July, Rwandan troops deployed to Mozambique to help the government regain control, and they now claim to have taken back most of the territory once held by the insurgents. But many who have been displaced by the conflict won't feel safe going home until security is restored. Louisa Victor is still living in a host community 100 miles away from her village.
We have nothing, nothing. I just want to go back home.
That's what everyone we spoke to said they want. In a region shattered by war, it seems the interest of big business has jeopardized the security of the people of Cabo Delgado. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Neha Wadaker in Cabo Delgado, Mozambique.
It's the famous light bulb going off story every school kid learns, how James Watson and Francis Crick discovered the structure of DNA and cemented their place in scientific history. But as William Brangham explains, a new book paints a more troubling picture of how this famous discovery came about and who else deserves some credit.
We're at the National Academy of Sciences, which is where the most celebrated scientists in America are members. But it was, for a long time, an old boys' club.
And also an old white boys' club.
An old white boys' club with very gray hair. That's the way science was socially constructed.
Howard Markel is a doctor and medical historian. And in his new book, The Secret of Life, he tells the famous story of James Watson and Francis Crick, who won the 1962 Nobel Prize in Medicine for their discovery of the double helix shape of DNA, which revolutionized the study of genetics.
That catapulted them into the pantheon of great scientists like Albert Einstein. And I'll bet if you are asked to name some Nobel Prize winners, I think everyone could say Einstein. But next would probably come Watson and Crick in terms of fame.
But in the book, Markel tells how that discovery was based in part on the work of a researcher named Rosalind Franklin, and how Franklin's contribution was downplayed and denied for years. It's what Markel calls one of the most egregious ripoffs in the history of science. The Secret of Life opens with that famous moment in 1953 in Cambridge, England, when Watson and Crick have just made their discovery and rushed to share it with the world.
And they ran from the Cavendish Laboratory out towards Free School Lane, 100 feet, literally 100 steps, I counted, to the Eagle Pub, which was a favorite watering hole of many Cambridge students and professors. And the way Watson described it, Crick winged into the Eagle and said, "We have discovered the secret of life."
A lot of people think that they do know this story, but remind us of these two central characters. Who were these guys?
Well, Watson was a young postdoctoral student. He had gotten his PhD at Indiana, got his BA at UChicago. He was DNA crazy. Long before other people thought DNA was the genetic principle. Now, Crick was a full-time graduate student, a permanent graduate student, as we used to call him. He was very loud, he had a loud laugh, and he was brilliant. And he was so brilliant, he would figure out your research questions before you did. So nobody really wanted to talk to him.
Before we get to the central tension of your book, can you just remind people who haven't followed this science why their breakthrough was so astronomical and so important?
Prior to 1953, no one really understood heredity, genetics, how we pass on traits to our children or our grandchildren, not to mention all the issues that DNA led to in terms of RNA and mRNA viruses and vaccines and all the other stuff, you know, that we use for medicine today.
Revolutionary things to this day.
Yes, I call it a light switch moment, because once that switch was turned on, nothing was ever the same. It changed everything. It was a major discovery. The problem is that it wasn't entirely their discovery.
Rosalind Franklin knew and interacted with Watson and Crick back in the 50s. She was at nearby King's College doing similar DNA research. She was an expert in X-ray crystallography, the use of reflected X-rays and complex calculations to work out the structure of incredibly small objects. Markel documents how, without her knowledge, James Watson was shown one of her key X-ray diffraction patterns, and Crick was shown one of her progress reports. Armed with that information, the two men figured out that DNA's structure had to be a double helix, as Francis Crick later admitted.
He said, "We didn't do the double helix because of things going pairs or something dreamy like that. We did it for a reason, because we had Rosalind's data." The reality is that if life was fair, which it's not, it would be called the Watson-Crick-Franklin model.
Is that right? Do you think that it's at all clear that they would have gotten there absent her data?
They absolutely would not. It would have been very hard for them. They might have eventually. The more interesting question is that Francis Crick said, of course Rosalind would have figured it out in a few weeks, just that we figured it out faster.
You also document in your book a very extensive campaign that those two gentlemen and others went to hide the fact that her data had been this aha moment for them. Why were they so set on denying her that recognition?
I think they never thought of Rosalind as a serious competitor of their level. I think it was chauvinism to the nth degree. and was very common in academic science on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean at that time.
Because as you do document in the book, she was a tough person. She didn't suffer fools. She was quick to point out your mistakes.
Yep.
And she wasn't necessarily the nicest person in the world. But as you also say, had she been a man, those character traits would have just been written off as eccentricities, whereas with her, they condemned her for it.
Yes, she didn't suffer fools gladly. She was very intense in her work and didn't like to be bothered. Like a lot of scholars, they get almost jarred when somebody interrupts them. And that was part of her, that's how she worked, you know, because she really did have to focus on things. She was a difficult person. That said, these other guys were rather difficult
right.
and odious in their behavior.
There are so many heartbreaking moments in this book. Rosalind dies of cancer, likely maybe because of the work she was doing and being exposed to x-rays. Right.
At 38.
She also doesn't really find out how central her data was right. to their discovery and their Nobel Prize. And she doesn't find out about this campaign that was waged to hide that from her.
Right, because she died only 5 years after the events. This conspiracy, and I call it that, because it wasn't just Watson and Crick, their bosses were involved too. And I asked her sister, Jennifer Glynn, about this a few years ago, and she said, oh, if Rosalind had known, there'd have been a big fight over that. Of that, I am sure.
At the very end of your book, and I do not want to give this ending away, but after building this very convincing case of the stolen data and the cover-up of the theft, as you put it, you're able to confront James Watson and put these questions to him. It's a very, very striking ending.
It's the best ending of any book I've ever written. And I guarantee it'll keep you on the edge of your seat as it kept me on mine. I challenged him about the whole Rosalind Franklin credit issue. His response was not pleasant.
To say
the least. And was quite definitive in his mind. I don't agree with it. But it was an interesting moment in my interviewing career, yes.
We'll leave it to the readers to
yes,
see.
Yeah.
The book is The Secret of Life, Rosalind Franklin, James Watson, Francis Crick, and the Discovery of DNA's Double Helix. Howard Markel, always great to see you.
Always good to see you.
The Creek Fire in Central California burned across 380,000 acres for 3 months in 2020. The U.S. Forest Service this summer said the cause of the fire was undetermined, but the most probable cause was a lightning strike. In a new documentary, Valley PBS of Fresno explores efforts to fight the fire and the impact on the surrounding community.
I remember getting on the radio, Operations Division Mike. Go ahead. Hey, we're priority traffic. We got 200-foot flame lengths at Flume Peak. The fire's moving towards the east, and we're gonna have structure impact within the next hour in the community Shaver. And we're copy. I was like, I need every additional resource that I need.
Afterburn, the Creek Fire documentary airs tonight at 7 p.m. Pacific on Valley PBS and streaming across PBS digital and social platforms. And we want to take note tonight of one of our own. Calvin Solomon worked as a graphic artist at the NewsHour for 33 years. In fact, he was the first African-American art director of a public broadcasting news program. In 2018, he was diagnosed with a brain tumor. Calvin Solomon died yesterday at 63 years old. Our deepest condolences are with his friends and family, especially his wife, Crystal. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.